Welcome to the Humans and AI Podcast, powered by AI Frontier Network. I'm your host, Flor La Orga. Each episode, we dive into the human story shaping artificial intelligence through the journeys of entrepreneurs, builders, and leaders. We explore the insights, challenges, and visions for the future of AI and humanity. Let's uncover the human side of AI together. Great. So nice to meet you, Darren. Thanks very much for joining the Humans and AI Podcast. I appreciate your time. I've read a little bit about you, and I'm very excited to talk more in depth about your background story, your career as an entrepreneur. Yeah, and then go more into it. Okay, you are now the CEO of AI Squared. So, well, you know that. So, you studied both computer science and electrical engineering in the past. So, do you think that having a technical background is very important to being a leader in the field of AI?
Flor, thanks for having me. It's an honor to be here with you. I really appreciate the opportunity. I joined the company about a year ago, initially as a president of the company, and I became CEO earlier this year. But I've been running tech companies for the last 30 years. So I've definitely been in and around the founding area of a company, but also running and growing and scaling and ultimately exiting tech companies. So it's been quite a career. I think from an academic perspective, being the degrees and the areas of study definitely help. For me, it was so long ago that I did my undergrad that I think it's probably more important to be curious today and want to continue to learn more so than what I learned back then. Like the computer science things that we did back in the day were C++ code, things that you really don't use that much anymore. But having the fundamentals helps a lot. It definitely, I think, gives me credibility as I work with our teams, at least fundamentally understanding what they're doing as opposed to coming from some other field. So that part definitely did help, yes.
Okay, so I saw that you actually exited two technology companies successfully, obviously because you exited. But I would like to ask a little bit about you've built some other companies that failed and they taught you some important lessons for these ones that you actually succeed.
Oh, absolutely. I think you learn more from failure than you do from success. You learn how to be resilient. Even in most fundraisings, most of the companies I've run have been venture-backed. The kind of the ratio of yes to no is incredible, right? You have to have resilience to be a fundraising entrepreneur. In my last company, we probably pitched over 110 investors before we got to one yes. So that's failing 109 times. I think when it comes to technologies, generally speaking, I also have learned that there's a cycle behind all of them. And if you, in some cases, hold out too long, you miss perhaps some of the height of the market, which also leads to some premiums when you exit the companies. You want to be mindful of that as well. And you never really can tell when you're at the peak or not. That definitely helped me to really understand and appreciate valuations of companies. Overvaluing a company too early can lead to a lot of challenges later on, both from an investor perspective, also from an employee perspective. Just a lot of lessons learned throughout the successes and the failures of running these tech companies.
Great. Also, you began your career founding companies in energy tech. So I found it very interesting that part too, before you moved into venture capital and enterprise software. So do you think there's any connection between all of them, these three parts?
Well, absolutely. I think energy tech, so in the world of energy, maybe I'll tell you a little bit of a story on how I got started in energy, because I think it's relevant to where we are today. I'm from Hawaii originally, and in Hawaii, we have islands, and it takes a long time to build power plants. But during the time of which I was growing up, we were growing in tourism, building big buildings, adding air conditioning, and yet not adding any more power production. And the problem there is there's not enough power to go around. So we would have these rolling blackouts and rolling brownouts where they would intentionally turn off the power. And in some cases, when I was at university, we had the lights go out and it's hard to learn and the air conditioning systems go out. And I remember thinking to myself, like, how can this possibly be? And how can you learn in this environment? And the idea was solve a problem, right? If I can help figure out a way to solve that problem, it'll make life better for everyone else. And that's what got me started on my very first company, where we began working on energy efficiency, finding ways to use less power. And if we did that across all of the consumers, all of the businesses, then it would help the grid. And as a result, we had more to go around. And that launched that first business, which really took off. It was very quickly growing. Obviously, in Hawaii, we have high energy rates, so it was a fertile ground. And we launched the business, got more efficient, figured out ways to make it better, and continued to grow. We eventually grew to about 14 states in the United States, all the way out to New York. We had offices and over 400 employees. And why I think that experience was really important, and that, by the way, led me to my second company, which was in solar, where we did solar energy generation. And those two companies were very relevant today, because if you think about the world of AI, there's an incredible thirst for air conditioning, power, cooling, just everything that you would need to produce the AI insights that we're putting strains on global grids now for. So there's definitely an appreciation on my part, understanding the challenges of power generation, siting data centers, where they have to be, where you're close to power infrastructure, close to cooling. And then in the world of venture capital, all of this stuff, especially early stage ideas, they're all non-profitable, right? So a lot of times you fund the growth to get to profit. And understanding the cycles there and the successes and the failures behind those companies as a VC really gives me an appreciation for where we are. I feel like it brings together the best threads of my career together now here in AI.
So having been in both roles as a founder and as an investor, do you think that we know that's a completely different roles, but what is similarities that they have being a VC and being a founder, for example?
Well, I think as a founder, you go from being the first person in the company. My very first company, it said that I was using my surfboard as a desk, because obviously this was in Hawaii. We had no office. It was just me. I had to make the coffee, clean the toilets, write the proposals, right? Even do some of the work in the field to actually help make the energy efficiency outcomes realized, like actually put on a tool belt and like re-retrofit light fixtures and things like that. I was doing all of it myself. I think as a VC, you don't do so much of that, but you see a lot of that. Like you have a broad breadth of companies that you're interviewing for your investment and a small set of companies you actually invest in. And I think having the experience as an entrepreneur made me a better VC because it helped me to appreciate the challenges that these founders go through, right? And how little time it is. We all as VCs, we want maximum ROI from our companies. And that oftentimes means we want to focus on things like sales and marketing. But the reality of an early stage founder is so much more than that, right? They're running HR, they're dealing with problems, they're dealing with supply chain issues, all those things, and negotiating contracts and working with new tools, and that challenges their time. So having gone through the life cycle from very early stage first person all the way up to thousands of people, I feel like I can appreciate the challenges that these companies are going through and these entrepreneurs are going through across their life cycle.
Beautiful. I actually like to hear that because I feel like I thought about it, like in the difference between VCs and like VCs who haven't been a founder. They don't really understand that you just have to make it profitable for us. But it's kind of, hey, it's not, there's so much struggle going on. I think most of them, if they haven't been in doing, like being a founder, they don't really understand it because they haven't done it. So thanks for sharing that because I think that's the kind of good to know as well for the VC part. You build and led companies from zero to exit. Like, as we know, you actually exited too, right? So how has your leadership philosophy evolved across these journeys, knowing that it's haven't been easy at all? We know that. So, yeah.
It's the mentality has changed quite a bit for me. And it also reflects, I think, the age which we live in. I remember the very first few companies I ran. So I've exited four companies over the life cycle of my time, two that were my own, two additional ones that I ran for VCs. So the total of four, but they're different. So in the ones I ran for my own, which were back in the early 90s and 2000 timeframe, the leaders of that time were like Jack Welch from GE or even Steve Jobs. You might remember Steve Jobs, who famously was very passionate about the way he ran companies, but also about his desire to get what he wanted. I remember there were stories where he would stand on top of tables and kick phones and things like that. And that was the way you ran companies back then, a little bit more command and control. And of course, as you head into like the 2000, mid-2000 era, where it became a lot less about that, the millennials rose up and it became a lot more about collective understanding, more maybe by committee, management by committee. You certainly couldn't get away with some of those behaviors from the previous generation. So as a leader across that period of time, I've had to adopt my style to the workforce, what was appropriate for that era. I think today, and of course, you gain wisdom along the course of the journey. And I think today, my style is much more about empowering others to lead. I realize that I'm at the end of my career, but how I can probably help the most, not just for my companies, but also for industry in general, is to help seed the next generation of leaders and help mentor them, help curate their experiences in a way where they're given opportunities, maybe even early in their career, to also succeed or fail, but that those experiences help them to become more polished as they continue to grow. I actually think having young entrepreneurs or young executives be put into situations where they fail is not a bad thing. I think it's actually a good thing. It's similar to the experiences I had as an entrepreneur, where I go out and raise capital and fail so many times, but you learn and get better each time. It's the same thing for these executives, right? Getting an opportunity to speak publicly and realizing that maybe they're not quite ready yet or they didn't practice enough, but let them do it anyway, because that experience and feedback is probably going to be so much more meaningful for them. Because they're going to remember it. It's going to sting. They're going to want to, like, I'm never going to let that happen again. Like, next time I'm going to be overly prepared. Now, obviously, you have to balance that out against when's the right time. You don't want to do that when you're pitching a $10 million contract to a net new client. That would probably not be the right situation for that. But there are other types of examples where you can give them those shots. And I think we should. And that's my current thinking.
Thanks for sharing, Darren. So, when you are scaling a company, how do you balance speed with human-centered innovation?
I think that they naturally balance themselves out. I don't believe in overselling or over-marketing ever. I never think that ever works. So you have to understand where you are and maybe lean a little bit forward from that when you are growing and scaling and going to market. But if you lean too far forward, I've seen so many times where broken demos destroy a company's reputation or overselling on a contract before the technology is there. And without having the end customer appreciate or understand where the state of the company really is or technology really is, that's also existential for those companies. So you have to balance them. You have to understand where your company is, where your human centricity is, where the market is, and figure out what's the right level of aggression you will take to market.
Yeah. So AI Square, for my understanding, enable AI to improve workforce for existing enterprises, right? So knowing this, in your perspective, should we expect AI to make everything easier for engineers and users, or just as a way to be much more productive but work as hard as they do?
I think it's all of the above. So what we do at AI Squared is we have a platform that connects to all of our customers, their data sources, wherever their data might live. Could be Google Drive, it could be a AWS database, it could be a Snowflake or Databricks or whatever your data sources are, whatever you store your data. You connect that into our platform. You bring your AI models into AI Squared. You can run the models against the data sources, and then it produces the insights. And then you take the insights and you put them into applications that you already have. So, for example, it could be Zoom or Teams or Slack. It could be Salesforce or SAP or QuickBooks. We put these AI-built insights that are not native to those platforms, we bring them in. So we modernize legacy applications right away. And that allows our end users to have state-of-the-art technology with the newest information real-time for them. So what it does is it gives them the ability to be more efficient in the work that they're doing. It allows them to be a lot faster so they can spend more time on other tasks. It allows them to offload some of the more trivial tasks to AI so that they're putting their advanced thinking into things that require human creativity. So I think it's an enabler. I think it's going to unlock the next chapter for humans to be able to be more creative, be more aggressive, do more things because it's a tool. And if used right, that's what it's supposed to do.
Great. I also hear that you just launched Sparks, if I'm not sure I'm saying the right way, which is a platform that unifies sales, finance, and operations data in real time. So could you tell us briefly the story behind what inspired its creation and what human or enterprise challenge it designed to solve? It is designed to solve.
Yeah, absolutely. So AI Squared is interesting because we came out of the Department of Defense and we built a bunch of technologies through government grants over the last 4 or 5 years. So we have had 10 grants and we built some of the most widely used technologies in AI deployment across the DoD, and it's been awesome. But what I realized was that those technologies require a data scientist. Like, you actually have to really understand AI and ML to use the tools we built, because we built them for that type of person. So I thought about it, like, we went to imagine like you go to a woodworker's workshop and they have a bench and they have all these tools and the tools are all over the place and it's dusty and it's unorganized. That was what AI Squared was. So the idea behind AI Squared was, how do we take those tools and put them away in a way where it becomes easy to find, much easier to use, and much more logical? And we did that in what we call the unified platform. That's our core platform. Now, that's still designed for a data scientist. And what I realized in talking to customers is that many of them don't need a whole bunch of these complicated tools. What they really need is a Swiss Army knife, like a one tool that can do everything. And that was the inspiration behind Sparks, was could we create a simple to use single tool that could connect the most basic things together for the mid-size enterprise? And that would be companies that are solo practitioners, like a doctor or attorney. It could be a mid-sized manufacturer, $50 million to $500 million, really any nonprofit organization. We're trying to build this product for them. And in that world, they don't have data scientists. It's an owner. And that owner or the executive director or line of business manager, they're not a data scientist. They're trying to figure out ways to make more money or save money for their company. And Sparks was intended to do that. So we took all of the complexity of data science, we flattened it out, we brought in the most important technologies, and we brought it into a simple to use AI. Think about it like an AI assistant. So we can put the assistant in any tool you like. You tell us. It could be Teams. And within that assistant, you can ask it questions like, hey, what are the holidays remaining in the year? Enter. And it'll go and find that information from your HRIS system and bring that back. It could be something like, hey, I want to get a P&L and I don't want to log into my finance tool because it'll take me 6 minutes to do that. I just type that in and boom, it'll give you the results right there. So it basically gives you the power of these complicated tools by simply asking a question into an assistant. And that's what Sparks is.
Very interesting. Thanks. Darren, which AI leaders do you respect and why?
Oh man, there's so many. Dario Amodei, I find his perspectives very interesting. The leader of Anthropic tends to be a little bit differentiated from some of the other schools of thought out there. So definitely always reading his things all the time. I find it to be very thought leading, frankly, there. I think Mustafa from Microsoft, who runs the AI labs there, very interesting as well. And what he does, I find to be very interesting. Most recently, he's been working on beefing up his talent. And I'm very curious as to see what's going on there. Jeffrey Hinton, the godfather of AI, I recently saw him at AI4, and he's oftentimes providing insights, like his futurisms on where AI is going. I like that quite a bit as well. Fei Li from Stanford, also World Labs, very interesting as well. The godmother of AI, also saw her recently at AI4, which is so cool. So really neat to see all these kind of luminaries there. But I think in this world, you have to not only follow the brand names that people recognize, but also everyone else, because AI is changing so fast. If you just recall back to like DeepSeek and companies that came out of nowhere, if you're not trying to scan the landscape for this and just only monitoring the big companies, I think you're being left behind. So we definitely try to monitor everything out there as much as we possibly can anyway. There's a lot.
Yeah, I know. Sometimes I found myself trying to, for example, check on X or on LinkedIn things that happen, but you just don't know. It's too much. And sometimes I'm like, I don't even know what is, because there's some, they contradict one, from one person contradict the opposite, the other one is just like, you don't know what to believe right now. So,
You need AI for that.
yeah, but sometimes even that you need AI for that, but like everybody using it such a different way, like all these kind of big companies, right, in AI and all these kind of famous people, so that obviously there's not just what they say, but it's also their own interests. So you have to be a bit careful, in my opinion.
Oh, absolutely. There's always a little bit of marketing there. Yeah.
Marketing and more, but yeah. Okay. So I'm quoting something that you said in one of your posts on social media, which says, while there's a lot of concern of AI taking over jobs, it's still the human touch that makes a lasting impression. That was in the AI forum that I checked that.
Yeah, so here's the way I think about it. I think a lot of people are worried about jobs being removed from AI. And what I tell them is, I think humans are creative beings. And I think it's the creativity that makes us unique. And what I mean by that is, when you think about a painting, it's not the perfection that you find typically most intriguing. Sometimes it is, but most of the time it's not. It's the imperfections. It's where the brush stroke is different than others, or the pressure you apply is different. It's why we say things in unique ways. I'll give you an example of one thing I think about. Remember that banana taped to the wall, that thing that got sold for, it was art, supposedly, and got sold for $6 million, I think it was, just a few months ago. That's natively human. And I think this is also what makes us unique. And you can't, I don't believe you're going to ever replace that. Maybe at some point in time in the future with AGI, if you listen to all those people that I talked about earlier, they think we can have reasoning to be able to get there, perhaps. But I think that's very inherently unique to humans. And I find that to be the most interesting. I'm actually looking oftentimes more for the imperfections in writing than I am looking for the perfect answer, because I find them to be most genuine. And those are the connections I definitely look for.
Okay. Also, I kind of read something that I found very interesting too, that I would like to discuss about. It's like you said, Silicon Valley's greatest advantage isn't code or capital, it's people.
Yeah. Yeah. And that's exactly what I mean here. It's, if you think about some of these tech companies, you hear about companies out there, for example, like Meta, that are offering hundreds of millions, billions of dollars in salary packages and people passing on them. How is that logical, right? It's not logical. If you think about things in terms of bits and bytes or ones and nulls, you should take that deal. But it's not that. People, in addition to the needs that they have, shelter, food, etc., people want to feel valued. They want to work in an environment where their ideas, they can contribute their ideas, and their ideas are respected and acted upon, and it becomes part of the nature of that company, the culture, if you will. And I think that's what inherently makes Silicon Valley very unique. We have a lot of those highly talented people. And a lot of these companies are very mission driven. People will work for them because they want to work for them. They want to work with the people they work with because they believe in the mission. And I think those are the companies that change the world. And that's what I think you have a lot more of. Not that it's unique to Silicon Valley, but it's definitely more unique to Silicon Valley than any place I've ever seen, where you have people that are working together to change the world. Because one, we believe we can here. But two, we have other people that are equally as smart, if not smarter, that challenge you every single day. And for me, that's inspiring. I don't mind going into a meeting and not being the smartest guy in the room, but learning from everyone else. And I feel like that rewards me, that fills my soul every single day when I work with those types of people.
So I guess that for what you said, it's the people. So when you are wearing your investor hat, what you focus the most, it's on the team, on the people, right?
Yeah, I think as an investor, different investors have different perspectives, I think, on that front. I tend to be a lot more focused on the people. I want to invest in people I trust. I hold myself to be very ethical and high in that nature. I'm a Boy Scout. I'm an Eagle Scout. I think I built a career based on doing what I say, saying what I do. And I want to work with people similar to that. And that aligns to the investment as well. I want to invest in people that are like that as well. I don't mind if you fail, like we talked about earlier. I think you will inevitably fail. I think it's how you recover from that failure. Some of the best technologies came from failure. Slack started off as a gaming company that failed. And if it wasn't for the investors that saw the potential behind the people, Slack would have never been born. It was the capital that they invested in a gaming company that was the original capital that allowed for Slack to be built. Slack was, of course, a tool that the gaming company had used to communicate. And as a result of that, they became this monster company that got acquired from Salesforce. I think it's really, you know, about that. It's about the people. It's about their tenaciousness. It's about their how they're built and how badly they want it. I don't like to invest in technology-only plays. I think inevitably those tend to be washed out by better marketing or better go-to-market or better personalities that will make better connections with end users. And I tend not to want to invest in people that are hypey, meaning that they come out as being very energetic at first, but over the long run, it's like a marathon versus sprint mentality. I've been a marathoner. I run five of them. I can appreciate how you have to balance your energy across all those miles. And I've seen people that have let off the starting gate and sprinted, and by mile four, they're dying on the side of they never finished the race. These startup companies are a marathon. They go long, and you have to understand that. You have to be able to manage your energy against that to make sure that you finish the race. Those are the kinds of people that I tend to invest in.
Great. I like that. I know startup is like a marathon. I really like that analogy. Yeah. Darren, if you were a beginner founder today, knowing that all it was going on with AI and all the technology that we have, innovation that we have today, wanting to start a company, how would you choose what to work on?
That's so hard, honestly. I think so, and I'll tell you the reason why it's hard, and I'll tell you the reason why I think it's easy. It's hard because there's so much white space right now. There's a lot of stuff happening, but AI or Gen AI in particular, I think, is beginning to change. We're hitting the trough of disillusionment where, you know, the expectations of what we expected to be are not quite there yet. And I think what you're beginning to find is companies especially are realizing it's hard to actually deploy these AI models at scale, meaning that you can pilot them easily. You can get a laptop and run a small pilot for a small set of users with a small set of sample data, and it works. And wow, the results are cool. And let's go do this across the company. It's that last part that's really hard. It's getting data from disparate data sources globally and dealing with compliance. It's being able to handle that velocity and amount of data, do so in a cost-effective way, do so in a reliable way, and do it 24/7, 365 every single day of the year. It's kind of like the marathon analogy. Those are hard things. So the reason why I think it's hard for a startup entrepreneur to figure it out is because they tend to go after the most hypey things. I want to build the next amazing foundation model. Yeah, that's great. You also probably need $50 billion to get there, maybe more. You've got OpenAI talking about $1 trillion AI data center infrastructures that are going to be coming now. So they're going to focus on that because that's the most obvious, but it's not there that I think they should be focusing on. It's the concept of picks and shovels during the gold rush. If you think about where the money was really made, it was selling Levi jeans or picks and shovels. And that's the tools that allow for the data to be mined in this case. And I think that's where it's easy because there's so much white space there. If you pick one of those things, I think as a first-time founder, my goal would be try to build a company and get it sold for as much money as I can so I have personal wealth and I can take a bigger risk in the next time. But more importantly, I build a reputation that will be able to be leveraged for the next company I build, which could then be a decacorn. So maybe the first company you focus on is maybe a couple $100 million exit. The next company is $1 billion exit. The next company after that is a $10 billion exit. You build it up over time. Whereas I think most first-time founders try to go for the decacorn to start. And that's really, really hard. So I would say focus on the white space, focus on the picks and shovels, because that's where the money is going to be made.
Thanks for sharing, Darren. So I've got one last question for you. You created over $1 billion in enterprise value. But when you think about legacy, what do you want your lasting contribution to AI to be?
Oh, tough one. So when you asked that question just now, I was thinking about it a little differently. So I want to give you the first answer first, and then I'll give you the last answer as best I can. I think the legacy of me is going to be how many people I am able to help become entrepreneurs themselves. So the number that you mentioned, it's 1.3 million in total net enterprise value. So that's subtracting out all the capital raised, that's the valuation increase. And I'm proud about that. And I want that number to continue to go up. But that's one person. And I think that I realize now where I can make a lasting impression is if I can go one to many, and if I can help the next 10 entrepreneurs do 1.5 billion, that number becomes staggeringly large, right? As they times 10 or whatever that number is, and then inspire them to also do the same for the next generation after that. So now we get to a $1 trillion type impact over kind of the legacy started perhaps by me and others in this generation as we think about this going forward. I think in terms of AI, what I want to make sure we do is we build responsible AI, that we build it ethically. In the same way I think about the values that I hold dear and true to being a Boy Scout and Eagle Scout, but also in the way I try to run my life, I think AI needs to be built in the same way as well. So in everything we do, we always start with that first. We always start with ensuring that we minimize bias, ensuring that we build ethical and responsible AI. If we can achieve that in what I touch and do, I would say mission accomplished, at least for me.
Thanks, Darren. It's been an incredible interview. I really like chatting with you. I found it very interesting, everything that you said, actually. So thank you very much for your time, and I hope that you have a great time too.
Yeah, for it was so nice to meet you.
Thanks for listening to the Humans and AI podcast. We are here to spotlight the people making AI more human, one story at a time. See you in the next episode.